Good morning, and you are listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo, bringing you your community stories. Today in studio, while music connects us all in different ways, for Tamara Menon, in 2006, she decided to return to India to follow her dreams of pursuing a career in music from a microbiology program at San Diego State University, where her journey took her places she never imagined. In 2010, her selection into a reality TV show, Sa Re Ga Ma Pa from Dubai, brought her to the beautiful city of Mumbai, India, where she worked and collaborated with various organizations. Today, as a founder of Yuva Arts Project, she is here in studio to share her inspiring journey and work that began with music. We are connected to one another, the land, the planet, our relations, traditions, cultures, and societies. He is compelled to explore these connections and their relationship to music. Dr. Gerard Yun, a community music professor and practitioner, intellectual music performer and researcher, and with a background rooted in Western classical music as well as musical traditions discovered and pursued alongside his formal training and professional work as a choral orchestral conductor. These areas include Zen Buddhist, Native American flute, Asian overtone singing, and West African drumming. So in studio, joining me today is Tamara Menon and Dr. Gerard Yun. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you both in studio this morning. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
It's wonderful being here.
It's our pleasure, truly.
Tamara, how did a microbiology student completely shift to a different genre here?
That's a very long time ago.
And so I decided, you know, here we go. I just got the courage from being 1 year in the U.S., tasted a little bit of freedom and said, you know what, I'm going to do music, and went back and told my parents, this is what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. And there started the musical journey from there.
You went to India.
Yes.
And you stayed in Mumbai for some time, right? During this whole journey with music?
Yeah, so I lived in Kerala for a few years.
Okay.
Because I was getting trained in Carnatic music. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned before, I'm really surprised that you found that the Sa Re Ga Ma Pa connection.
Yeah, and she sung with producers too.
So yes, I did a lot of commercial work when I was in Mumbai. Mm-hmm. And then I slowly got into teaching and got involved with this NGO, Prerna, that is an anti-trafficking organization in Mumbai.
Okay.
And then I got very inspired to do something through music because I could see for myself that there were changes that were happening. There was a positive impact, even if it was just that hour, but it was doing a lot for the children there, and I decided that I wanted to take it further from there. Yeah.
Your work with Prerna, you joined an organization there called Songbound, is that right?
Yeah, so Songbound is based in the UK, and it was this vision of this French horn player who came down on a tour to India, who saw all of these kids who had no access to music education, because most of them are on the streets, or they're underprivileged, mm-hmm. and so he thought he wants to bring music to them. Okay. And so I was one of the so-called choir leaders who went into these different NGOs. So Prerna is not the only NGO. I worked with other NGOs as well. But during that time with Songbound is where most of that work with marginalized communities happened. And that's how I got here. Yeah.
And Dr. Gerard, you have your own background for over 30 years in learning and teaching and, you know, the experience with music. So your outlook on music is completely different from, you know, the regular music genres we keep hearing.
Yeah, so. I don't know what regular is. I have no idea, right? I studied a lot of classical music, but it's interesting. Yesterday, I was in Stratford actually doing songwriting, taking a lesson with a pretty well-known songwriter, and she's kind of leading me back to my musical roots, which were really in more of a folk music type genre and doing things like songwriting and expressing things that people want to do with music and mm-hmm. things that connect people with music. I gave all that up and did years ago and did the classical route, doing all the education and all that formal. And in my mind at the time, the mind of a, I don't know, I was not a teenager. I think I was 20. I don't know. It's weird, right, to think back. And was, wow, that's, I need to see what that world is about. So I sort of left behind. I mean, even to the point of even, I had like 200 songs I had written in this book, and I burned them. I wanted to break that bridge. That's nuts. If a student came to me and said, I'm going to burn my songs, Dr. Yuen, I'd say, no, that's nuts. Don't burn your songs. Just keep them for a bit.
Absolutely.
They're part of you. And so coming back to reclaim that's different. So yes, the experience has been amazing. And then now to have gone this full circle and to come into a program of community music mm-hmm. is such a huge opportunity. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, and your aspect, you know, your central aspect of your practice is academic sources, and you talk about students, you want to bring social change involved in it. So how does that play along with music?
Oh, you just have to know right away that it's a nutsy journey. Whenever I move from an academic or an institutional standpoint or background into the real life or in the nuts and bolts of community, mm-hmm. the nuts and bolts of real people, it's always surprising. And you may, like in my case, I might theorize about something or think I'm encountering something, and then something completely different really arises. This really was the case in working with Tamara mm-hmm. and the Yuva project.
Okay.
That there were many things we assumed, right?
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
We didn't know. And,
yeah.
and there you were with direct experience. And so you really had to lead us. But then the kids got here mm-hmm. and came to Kitchener-Waterloo, and a whole nother set of realities really happened. So it allows music, and I think academics as well, who often don't deal in reality or some sort of curated version of reality, to sort of, it gets in your face, and then you really do have to be resourceful, come mm-hmm. up with great solutions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's overall a really hopeful and liberating process. Not without like a lot of problems.
But, absolutely. Yeah. And with you, Tamara, so your experience back, take us back to your days in Mumbai where you actually went down and saw what it was to be in Mumbai's red light area district, right? And connect with those kids. So I kind of understand it to some extent, but our listeners who are listening, to get them a perspective of what a red light area would be, what we would like to hear from you. Your experience being
I
there.
I have a relationship with that place now, and it's very profound now that, I mean, even with the project happening, mm-hmm. but I remember that when I took up the NGO, I said I would go there mm-hmm. to Kamatipura, and Kamatipura is the name of the red light district, and Prerna is situated there. Mm-hmm. In fact, I started going to another place called Navjeevan, and they do the same kind of work, but mm-hmm. with the younger kids. Mm-hmm. And the first time I went there, I was terrified because I didn't even know what a red light district was. And I had to be told, this is after I had said, yes, I will absolutely go to the red light district. Yeah. And then I went home and I told my mom, you know, I'm going to the red light district, Kamatipura, to give music sessions to these kids. And she said, what?
I know. You know? Have had a lot of barriers getting there even,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. My family was very, you know, worried about me going to that district. And initially, they tried to tell me, you know, probably this is not what you should be doing. And but with experience of going there, I mean, I used to go there in the daytime and I could tell my parents, like, yeah, you know, I'm going the daytime. There's so many people in Mumbai. There's no way I'm going to get into trouble. It's all good. And it was just really just another busy part of Mumbai. Of course, when I would pass the brothels, like, I could see the women stand outside, and that for me was always like, it hit me, and it was a sort of like a pain in my heart when I would mm-hmm. see them standing outside in the heat, you know, their clothes, and you know, you just don't expect them to be in that sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
But and also their living conditions are not great. And then moving forward working with the NGOs, I realized that, you know, it was even worse than I thought. I mean, they're kind of, I mean, the trafficking situation there is probably very extreme. I know it happens in different ways around the world, but that is extreme. They are caged. They're put in the dark for days. Their spirit is broken. So really, they're dehumanized, and they're kind of like puppets, and they do whatever they've been asked to do. And so when they have these children, it's really hard for them to be, you know, a mother or like a parent in that sense, to take control over the child's life, because they really don't even have control over their own lives. Absolutely. But they want that for their child. So I've seen that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that need there, and seeing the children are so loving. I mean, they're children, right?
Yes.
And
absolutely.
All they want is love and affection. They want to play.
Mm-hmm.
They
don't understand what's going on.
Well, actually they do.
Because
they, a lot of them have even sat in their rooms with their mothers when they're very young and seen what has happened. And they're very lucky if they've not, you know, been witness to that. But also, even though that, you know, going through all that trauma, I find that they have so much resilience and so much strength, and so much love for the world still, that it really makes you want to do something for them. That's where all of that motivation came to me, because there were times when I would go at night. And this is when I would go to prayer. Now, those were night sessions.
Mm-hmm.
So coming back, you know, taxis don't wait for you, because they're like, oh, what are you doing here? And what work do you have in the red light area in the evening? And I have, you know, I'm telling them I have music sessions here for the children. And they're like, what? And they don't want to believe me, you know. So it was really hard to get a cab back home. And that put my mom under a lot of stress, my family under a lot of stress. A couple of times I couldn't, you know, answer the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, you know, so worried. But even though, you know, going through all that, I would say what really brought me back to that area and my relationship with that area is really the children and the mothers.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very strong relationship that I have.
And you also hosted here in Canada to raise funds for this program and the organization. You did, was it a daughter and dad event?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Wow, you've done your homework.
So you did that event. You hosted that.
Yeah.
But my question is, because I don't know how many of these kids actually know who their father is. How did this event come about? Like the concept of dad and daughters versus, you know, because your relationship with moms are more stronger than the fathers. So.
Yeah, that was actually one of the most challenging fundraisers we did. And we did it with Eva Short.
Okay.
We'd collaborated with Modern Mummy Company in Guelph. And she just came forth and she said, I want to help with this. How can I contribute my skills? And this has been the case, like, always. Just people in the community coming forth and saying, how can we
help
using our skills? And that really resonated with the team. And we were talking about how, you know, it just came about. John from our program, who taught us the business course, John Beresford. He you know, said, you know, this is, you know, we don't have a lot of events with dads and daughters, right? I mean, you would know this, Dr. Yan, right? And so this is just a way to initiate that and bring that, kind of encourage that wherever we go. Mm-hmm. Wherever we go, we want to encourage those relationships between parent and children.
Absolutely.
Because it's so important. We see that in the red light district.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how this all came about, really.
And Dr. Yan, your work with UWA Project, for how long have you been a part of this?
Okay, so it's changed. It's changed a bit, because my role, I saw myself, well, I'm the teacher guy, and I'm just going to support the students and support Tamara. And we had a social justice and music class called Sing Fires of Justice. Now that's related to another community thing that happens every year the last 12, 13 years here in town. And she took this class, and of course they have to do a project, and she said, well, I want to do this project. At that point it didn't have a name or anything.
We didn't have a name, that's true.
This was about 2 years ago, and of course everybody in the class had just been listening to her talk, and she's so articulate. and about these kids, and they're just nodding, right? They have no idea what, you know, red light district. And so I have to confess, I'm kind of the same way. So my role has really been one of support. And then it wasn't until after the children came, after all of this work and the raising of money and the partners and all the things we did, that I realized, oh, I'm not on the sidelines. I guess I'm part of the team. Oh, I really am in it, like up to my neck. And being able to see that sort of and feel and experience that sort of level of commitment, I think that's what resonates with the partners. That's why they jump in and say, whatever you need, I will come in and I will help you. Tell me what I can do to help you to be a good partner for these kids and for what you are doing. And so there is something magnetic about that. So my role is changing.
Okay.
And it has, I think it has also changing me quite a bit. It's easy to hide behind that academic shell or just being the teacher.
And then for sure.
For that human part. That's what community does. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah. But it resonates with people. It, you know, changes the perspective and opens up to a completely new world other than the one that you have created, right?
Yes.
I must add, though, that Dr. Yan has been a source of empowerment for me personally and also for the entire team. And I think if that source didn't exist, would have been very hard for us to go through the entire process and not fall more times than we did.
We fell a lot.
Yeah, so I'm going to touch upon that as well, because somewhere along I did see that you had your own challenges. Before we get into that, just so our listeners can understand what UA Project was all about, if you can kind of throw light on that, the whole project was about.
You know, we're still having this discussion as to what it is, because we had this vision of it, and it's changing over time. But the whole point of it was to bring children together in one space and have them explore the possibilities in life, what the present is, address that, and for future possibilities of change and positive impact, not just for themselves but also for their communities. So that's what it was, but it's been changing throughout the process, because the youth have a way to speak and to bring their ideas forth. So really, they're driving this whole thing themselves without even knowing it. And we're just providing them that space to do that, really. And in the process, we forgot how this would transform all of us, is what we were talking about. And it's not just transformation for the just kids. The kids and their communities, but it's a transformation of the entire community as a whole, as they connect and bring these resources together and achieve something greater than themselves.
Mm-hmm. Can I add a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah.
So as an intellectual, I thought about this all the way along. Oh, it makes no sense to bring a few kids from India at great expense, yet here are all these partners saying, no, we want to. Yeah. So we're doing this, right? And then to watch the whole process unfold, especially in the 2 weeks that the children were here with us, and to see that something, and to be in the presence of it, something is happening, something is transforming in the community. And so we haven't done the work yet to really see. We haven't looped back. We haven't had time yet to ask everybody, what has really happened? Mm-hmm. And then what do you want to do now?
Yes.
How, what do you want to do together? And so I think going forward, this is what's going to help shape what UVA becomes now.
From
what it was kind of like a kind of crazy idea in a social justice class.
Thank you.
But then it just kept catching fire. And of course, people have very distracted lives nowadays.
Mm-hmm, they do.
And school is hard.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
But even through all of that, it still came up and was able to communicate, even through the idea of working with these kids, enough empathy, enough compassion, and energy. But I frankly was not prepared for the degree of transformation I felt in the community while they were here. I can't really even articulate it very well, because we haven't studied it yet.
So the kids who came by to Canada, they came all the way from Mumbai, India. And how many kids were here?
Eight kids and two social workers who accompanied them.
Okay. Yeah. What was the reaction of these kids when they knew they were going to come here? And I know there were certain hurdles with their whole visa process, and that was a completely different...
They hadn't processed it. And initially, it was a struggle to get them motivated to go and to go into their appointments and bring the papers. And their mothers had to be motivated to bring all these papers. Because starting from birth certificate, we had to... Prerna had to arrange for everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this was not a small thing that they had to do. They had so much paperwork to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was convincing the government officials.
Mm-hmm.
So through the whole process, the kids, I mean, they've been told that they don't stand a chance in the community already. Like it's already in their, it was already in their minds that this was not going to work out. And mm-hmm. so I remember doing the orientation for them a year before. And I remember...
this was back in India?
Yeah.
Okay.
So last year I did go back because the passports weren't coming through and we had to really push it forward. And so I'd gone back, and what I noticed that, you know, I did a small orientation to show the kids where, where they're going to live, because that had all been arranged already. And I was like, this is where you're going to be. These are the people you're going to meet. And this is what you're going to do. You're going to do all these different kinds of workshops. And they didn't know what to say. They were very blank. Like, they gave me blank expressions, and I thought, you know, what is going to bring that connection forth? Because they're so disconnected from this. Came down to food, right?
Oh,
of course, it comes down to food.
Yes,
yes. So pizzas and burgers. And once I told them that that is Canadian food, they will find it here. We'll get it for them. They were just thrilled.
That's what sparked the joy there.
Yeah, and it's funny, right? That's the little joys in life, but they mean so much. Moving forward, as the passports came through, I could see the change, and they were more positive about going and getting the visa stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
Once the visas came through, oh my gosh, it was like, but yeah, that took a long time because they were denied visas first.
Okay.
And so they had to go through that as well, being, you know.
Because that also puts a lot of negative energy and
it does.
Discourages them from, you know, the society they live in too. It's a lot of up and downs emotionally for those kids as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And being told that their socioeconomic status is a reason or is a block for them to be mobile in the world is, you know, devastating probably to a child, because then they're thinking ahead and thinking, oh, maybe I can never leave the red light district, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, well, Dr. Yun was an Erin Windibank and MP Chagger. Like, we had this little team, and Chris, our lawyer, Chris Daw.
Mm-hmm.
We, like, literally that team helped me so much. And helped Prerna so much with like paperwork and the visa process. And that's how it finally worked out. And when it did work out, I can't tell you how thrilled the kids were.
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. So they got here. This was sometime in May of this year, was it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It was still cold, so
not as cold as some Mays.
But for kids coming all the way from Mumbai, India, landing here, what was their experience, and what was the 2 weeks comprised of for them that they were here? I would ask that to both of you.
Okay. Yeah, I remember the first day. It was very cold and it was raining, and I thought, we're gonna stay indoors. We're not gonna go to Victoria Park. And we're just going to have a little painting session. I went there, and the first thing they tell me is, Didi, we want to go to the park. And I said, it's raining. Can you not see it's raining and it's cold?
Oh, yeah.
They said, no, we have 2 weeks here. We're going to make the most of it.
That's amazing.
So it was so cold. I think it was like 4 degrees or something.
Yeah,
and it was raining. Yeah. And we went to the park, and they played there for an hour. They also danced, and they took pictures. Several pictures with all the flowers and the trees.
That's lovely.
And that's when I thought that this, for them, is, you know, they don't care about the cold. They're just happy to be here at this point. Yeah.
That's great.
Dr. Ian, like, what was your reaction when you met them for the first time?
Well, you know what? I'm so curious because I didn't see this first minute. And I'm curious, Tamara, about at the airport. Like, were they all jumpy excited?
Well, when they got here, they were extremely tired.
Okay, so they've been flying all night or something.
Yeah.
But that was their first flight experience as well.
They wouldn't have been flying anyway.
Yes, they did not complain. And I'm not surprised. They don't complain. They got into the bus and they all slept throughout, like, the entire way. When we got home is when they came to life.
Okay.
And then they just started, and then I think they didn't sleep the first night because they were jet lagged, but there's so much energy in them, so much energy throughout the trip. I mean, I guess you saw a lot of that, right?
Yeah. Well, the very first thing that happened was, and keep in mind that we've created this 2-week schedule of them in interactive music activities, in community music, and the very first thing is music therapy with a music therapist. And with Dr. Colin Lee, head of music therapy. Yeah. And he had no idea what to expect. You know, we didn't have any idea what to expect. Mm-hmm. So being, a good colleague, I said, I'm going to come and help. I will just be there. And so here come the kids. And we only saw half. This is the first impression, right? And they're in this kind of weird foreign space. There's the music therapy room. And I know, it's so strange. And then we get into playing instruments and improvising. And of course, they're wonderful, immediately wonderful. And so the sense of innate musicality, I think, kind of calmed us down. But it happened right away. I mean, it wasn't super spontaneous. We kind of warmed up into it.
Yeah.
And then it just got better, and it just got better and better and better. Now, we repeated those sessions at the end, and it was unbelievable.
Yes,
the
sessions had transformed themselves, right?
Yeah. Well, it transformed us as instructors, and I know our music therapists on staff. It really was quite a profound experience for them, too.
In what way?
I think just that raw joyfulness. That these are, when we really look and we're trying to be empathetic and do all the things we've been trained for, what I think we all saw, training or not, was these are kids. This is regardless of any imposition of socioeconomic status, upbringing, trafficking, all that. These are kids, and right now they're pretty happy, and right now they're hitting that drum really loud. And
they were.
Can we stop that? No, let's not stop it. And so it becomes like we're just seeing kids.
Absolutely.
That was the main reference point. Not not others, not visitors from India, not this sort of impression we get, and I don't know why we have it, of people who are miserable.
Yes,
right?
And
well,
it gave
kids must be miserable, but they were joyful and alive.
I must say, they gave us so much energy because we had to go through all of those hurdles right before they got here. So the team, I mean, Olivia, Lisette, and Sarah, and Georgia is not here. She's in France now, and Dr. We were just like so tired. From just, going through all those hurdles and making it through. But when the kids got here, they gave us so much energy. And so we knew immediately that this was not about, just us doing something for them, right? And it was an exchange. And we were giving each other energy and joy and music and dialogue. It was a two-way exchange, it was just beautiful.
And they very much like turned up the viscerally. It was like they turned up the brightness.
Yes,
it's like, oh, I'm driving to Kitchener. Hey, they're the kids.
So do you think music therapy does play a huge part in people's lives, and it brings joy? And you've seen the change in those kids from when they were here. Their journey back home, I'm sure there is the stress, there's the anxiety of going back to where they came from. How did that play into the 2 weeks that they were here? What that would still be at the back of their heads, but being in that moment, present moment, enjoying the time they had here, were there talk about, what life would be after?
Yes. I must also say that, it was this is a very important question because you mentioned music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And music definitely was an integral part, but there was so much of the other arts that we explored with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was intentional. So there was theater because Empty Space was our partner.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was RPR workshops with Neruda Arts. There was song sharing again with Inshallah Choir, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And Gary Diggins did the sound therapy. You did an amazing songwriting workshop with the kids, Dr. Yan.
We still have these wonderful pictures that they created as their sort of music scores, but they're mm-hmm. wonderful. And that all happened sort of immediately.
Yeah. Like and then Healing of the Seven Generations, the Indigenous organization did the moccasin workshop and a spirit painting workshop. So
mm-hmm.
really, it's been a very like holistic experience, not just for them. Oh, I must say that even the youth who were involved here in the exchange were the newcomer, newcomer and the Indigenous youth,
mm-hmm.
and whose voices were equally important in this conversation, because the things that came out of those exchanges were so profound that we did not expect that, mm-hmm. right? So that holistic experience, I think, is what created that special experience for them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I must thank all of those organizations, but also going back home, they've already started sharing some of that. So they've already started to become leaders, and they've already like conducted a first Arpiera craft session.
That's no fantastic. Way.
Yeah, for all the other youth.
Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're already... So obviously, they got something out of it, and that's mm-hmm. why they want to share it with all the youth back home.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing that by itself is like, we did something.
Right. Something happened.
Something happened. Yeah.
And that's magical, right? Because they are carrying what they learned here back there, and they become the leaders for the next group of kids mm-hmm. down there.
Yeah.
In doing so, and we just spoke about music, so I'm going to get... the two of you to kind of, you know, help with our listeners. Like, I would like you to share some music that you guys have created and have sung so our listeners can enjoy some of it too.
We have that little recording we might be able to
put on air. Yeah, absolutely.
And you're singing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That one might be good, and we might be able to do something. We actually find that when, and Tam is becoming more typical of some of my students in that when you walk into my office, I kind of say, okay, well, let's sing or something. So we do try to make music.
Yep, music is important to us.
Complaining at each other.
So do you have something you want to sing now?
What we have in front of you, I should say that I'm a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University locally, mm-hmm. and that's the only, it's right now, it's the only community music, it's the only place in North America you can get a community music degree.
Mm-hmm.
And
so, wow.
And Tam was one of our first undergraduate students in that new degree.
Yes, so, that's true.
That's fantastic.
So great, a very, very high bar, she mm-hmm. has said. There's a funny little box in front of me. And we'll get this side. And
it's the Shruti box.
Like it looks like a wooden box. It mm-hmm. looks like something you'd put cigars in.
And oh, my gosh.
And there's a funny, it's about the size of a big cigar box. And it is a Shruti box. The Shruti box is actually used in traditional Indian music
mm-hmm.
That Tam practiced for years mm-hmm. called Carnatic singing in southern India. Before Tam was here, we had a guest artist come by from India, and it was mm-hmm. Father Paul.
Yeah.
Father Paul Putangal, who is the singing priest of India. So he sort of got our program and got me sort of started on Carnatic music. And then she appears, right? And she had studied at his school.
Right.
So it was a very weird, just a weird connection. And you actually studied with his teacher.
Yep, that's right.
Gosh, see, that's amazing. So it sounds like this. Now, it actually was originally not an Indian instrument originally. Yeah, it was a Dutch-British instrument. Yeah.
Right.
So it has what looks like a keyboard on it.
So I'm just going to be improvising here on the word Anandam, which means joy. Yeah. Anandam.
was beautiful. Thank you so much. Beautiful. That was beautiful.
Thank you for having us here.
That was gorgeous. Thank you so much. I'm sure our listeners have enjoyed it too. Addressing back to the trafficking, the human trafficking, my question to you, Tamara, is from working so much on it and seeing the things that you've seen, do you think still exists here in our community? And is that something that we need to talk about more openly, address those issues? Because that's a huge part of people are not really aware of what really goes on. Mm-hmm. And either we shut that topic down or we just refuse to talk about it.
Right.
Right.
Trafficking is an issue in KW. And this is something that I've spoken to the local community about. I know that there is an organization, anti-trafficking organization here that works, that deals with this problem. But also having numerous conversations with our Indigenous partner and with the newcomer, well, the newcomer population too, but more so with the Indigenous organization. They see this a lot within their community. And of course, a lot of it, as you said, is not spoken about and does not come out in the news, or, you know, it's in the background. It's really not talked about. And that by itself, the fact that we did this, they were so thrilled that they could come out and be part of this and also like tell their stories about trafficking as well. And it's important for people in the community to know, because anyone at any point mm-hmm. can be in a vulnerable position, and that's how you become more susceptible to human trafficking.
Right.
And you really don't know where that vulnerability starts and you know where that begins and where that comes into your life. And I think it's important to be aware that this is a problem even here in Canada, and that there are ways to combat that and to combat that, like, even within your household. Mm-hmm. You know, how are you aware of your surroundings? How strong is your community? The more strength there is in your community, mm-hmm. The less vulnerable people are going to be in your community, and the less trafficking there is going to be in your community. And this is just a very simple concept.
It is.
But
it's profound.
Speaking about it is the first step, mm-hmm. like being aware, speaking about it, and then doing something about it,
yes.
Well, and we really do have that something. I'm creating connections through music or doing almost anything together.
Yeah.
So that you are aware of one another and who actually is down the street. We still live in a really strange culture where we don't really know our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what their backyards look like and stuff like that. We just, we're still there.
Mm-hmm.
We're still fairly isolated from one another. So things that do bring us out or give us some awareness. Community music does a lot
yes.
of that. Just sights you up with, oh, you're my neighbor, I'm making music with you. It's when mm-hmm. It rains on you too. That will give us that ability to maybe just keep each other that much safer.
Yes.
Because we really are responsible for one another's safety. It's not going to be the government or the people who are painting those really mm-hmm. cool crosswalks now mm-hmm. in KW. But we actually, just some awareness
yeah.
of keeping the neighbor safe, keeping our elderly safe. And how else could trafficking, this always confuses me, how else could trafficking be so prevalent and such a huge money thing
yes.
and then be invisible? That's
absolutely,
absolutely remarkable. It mm-hmm. means that in some way we are just not awake.
Yes. Yeah. And our community needs to come together to help one another, right? Like
yes.
both of you mentioned.
Always.
You got to be aware of your surroundings. You got to look out for each other. And
I must tell you that doing this project was the most positive feeling, just even personally. Being an activist, and, you know, you can sometimes feel alone in this. Even as a team, you can feel alone in this, right?
Very alone, yeah.
But there are organizations, like all of our partners, Empty Space and Prerna, like, they do so much work, and all of the other collaborators that I mentioned, mm-hmm. they do so much work on an annual basis, and they are like fighting every day to make, you know, to provide opportunities for people to come together
mm-hmm.
and know each other.
Absolutely.
Even if at the very surface level, but make music, dance, you know, watch plays, you know, these are things that brings the community together, and they do this every day, and that's what keeps us going. So yes, I would tell people that you know, there are opportunities to make this to end trafficking in the most simplest ways ever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what are the next steps and where is UA Arts headed today?
It's funny, we've been talking about this because of the inspiration we've gotten and the tremendous support from the community.
Yes.
That I think the sky's the limit.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to also increase our skills. It's a learning curve, not just for us, I think for the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
That we tend to think in these big, broad projects like UVA, we're going to take 2 years and raise all this money. But we almost blew it when the visas were denied.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see that coming. That's one of the most obvious things we could have seen coming.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a different approach is now needed. And that is not just defining and having vision. You hear a lot about that in organizations, right?
Absolutely.
And then nobody does anything. They have these meetings, and we're famous for this at universities. We meet a lot, right? And it's expensive to have meetings, and it takes time. And so what about doing smaller increments, failing, learning? And so as UVA moves forward, looking towards what we can do here and with the international intentions as well, working with the partners working and maybe doing some pretty difficult things, but doing them in a small, protracted way so that if and when, it's inevitable we're going to fail. So when we fail, that we are able to get up, learn something from that, and then exceed at the next iteration, rather than waiting 2 years and going, oh no.
Yes. Yeah. And again, it's about all these relationships that we have in the community now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we need time to honor those relationships. We can't just be, they're beyond work relationships,
exactly.
Right?
Yep.
They're more profound. They're more,
it's cause and
deep
impact
relationships
with you guys and the
organization. That need time, that need nurturing. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't expect a tree to grow within, a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It takes time. And we need to give the youth time. And I always say the underlying intention, the hope for the youth and hearing their voices. So we need to also listen to what they want, right? In the future, what they need.
Yep.
And move
from there.
Move
according
to that.
Well, they're at the middle of that vision, but it brings up.
Yeah.
Tam's always telling me, it's about hope, and hope is at the center. I've always said that hope is a bit of a double-edged sword, and that edge over there is, if it doesn't work, you've been hoping for years or decades, or the kids hope, and suddenly the project maybe fails or something, that that hopelessness also has to be addressed.
Yes.
Now, what is so wonderful is that, like I said, where they kind of turn up the intensity and volume.
But
that
through failures is how we learn.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Teaches so much.
And support one another and find ways. I'll tell you, just the simplest things against hopelessness are playing a song together or drumming together. It's like you can't really be hopeless, even if you're a hopeless musician. You can't really be hopeless. Like, you're like, okay, I'm going. And those moments of light really help in these longer struggles, which we feel are like so overwhelming.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And if people need to read about your work and connect with the organization and reach out to you, where do they go?
So they can definitely get in touch with us through our website. That's www.yuvaartsproject.org.
Okay.
And UVA is spelled as a YUVA.
Yeah, tell them what it means. What's UVA mean?
UVA means youth in Hindi, yes.
That's fabulous. Thank you, Tamara and Dr. Gerard, for sharing with me and our listeners the fabulous work both of you have been doing, not just in the community, but internationally with the collaborators and everything that you're bringing to this community. Thank you again for being here and sharing with us. And Tamara, you want to say something?
Yeah, I have a couple of thanks to say.
For sure.
I really would like to thank the team. They're not here with me. Olivia, Lisa, Sarah, and Georgia, they've been with me through this entire process.
Mm-hmm.
And we have done this together
together
with all the partners. So I wanted to shout out a huge thanks to all of them and all the sponsors and Laurier too. Like, they've really supported us, right?
I concur with there's so many people that we just can't
yeah.
name. The community really came forward, and not just
yes.
the community,
yeah.
but very specific, surprising
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a whole other set of stories.
Yeah.
Right yeah.
there.
Yep.
And thank you
thank
for giving us this space to
oh, thank
for
you.
Us to tell our stories.
It was an yeah. absolute pleasure to have you both here. And this is not going to be the end. We'll connect more and, you know, hear more stories. I'm sure they're different collaborations you'll and projects you're going to be working on, and we look forward to seeing what more amazing work and how we as a community can help and be a part of it. So thank you guys mm-hmm. so
deep
much.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.